Remember the good old days before Microsoft Word had autosave? You'd type up some important document and then your computer would freeze and you'd lose hours of work just because you forgot to hit save? Well, that's what it's like going online without ExpressVPN. Every time you're connected to an unencrypted network, whether it's in an airport, a hotel, a cafe, or anywhere, your online data is not secure. Any person on that same network who knows what they're doing can gain access to your personal data. Bank logins, credit card details, passwords, all the stuff you don't want people seeing. Unfortunately, hacking has become much easier than it used to be. People don't even have to be exceptionally skilled to do it, and there's a lot of money to be made by selling your information on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. It's incredibly easy to use. Once the app is running, you literally click one button to get protected. And it works on your phone, laptop, tablet, and more, so you can stay protected on the go. I've been using ExpressVPN for a little while now, and I can rest easy knowing my info is safe and secure. I've heard horror stories of people who've been hacked, and it sounds like a massive pain to try to get any resolution in the aftermath, so I am not interested in finding out what that process is like. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/film.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, June 21st, 2024. On today's episode of the show, I'm going to present an interview with the Bike Riders writer-director, Jeff Nichols. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. It's just me on today's episode. Before I go any further, I want to apologize for there not being an episode yesterday. The priority of my job is with what's going on at slashfilm.com, and yesterday we just simply had too many things happening for me to be able to get away and record. So I'm sorry about that. But I'm very excited to present my conversation with Jeff Nichols, who is one of my favorite working filmmakers. He is the director behind movies like Shotgun Stories, Take Shelter, Mud, and Midnight Special, among others. And in some surface level ways, The Bike Riders is similar to the movies that he's made in the past. His most recent film, Loving, was a period piece involving a character taking photographs of the key subjects in the story, which also happens in The Bike Riders. And his movies are often focused on families, but The Bike Riders widens that definition to include this group of outsiders who form a motorcycle club in the early 1960s. But in many ways, this feels like him expanding his scope as a director, getting out of his familiar Southern setting for the first time in a major way, and really taking a bit of a swing here as a director. So I liked The Bike Riders a lot. The first thing I said as soon as I walked out was, we need more movies like this. There should be an option for us to see at least one film like this every month. This is like a sturdy, high-quality movie made by somebody who knows what the heck they're doing. It has this mixture of exciting young talent and veteran performers and terrific character actors all doing their thing. And it just feels like a throwback to a different era of filmmaking. So I was very impressed with it. I thought a little bit about The Wire, the HBO show, when watching this, because I think both projects do a good job of depicting a subculture being formed in opposition to the status quo, and then eventually a younger generation comes along and encroaches on the established norms and rituals of that subculture. But in The Wire, Avon Barksdale and Stringer Bell, characters like that, are trying to work around a system that has failed them. And in The Bike Riders, I feel like the gang forms because basically a bunch of white guys are bored with their lives and want an excuse to ride motorcycles together. So I just thought it was a fascinating dichotomy there, I guess, to see what started out as this pretty innocent collection of outsiders in this movie become larger than life and then eventually be corrupted by violence and consumed from the inside out. So I thought that was a cool little parallel to one of the best shows ever made. There's also a fascinating love triangle in this movie, not in a Challengers way, where if you'll remember my conversation with Justin Karitzkis, the writer of Challengers, he was talking about how all of the points on the love triangle needed to meet in that film. But in this case, it's more like two points on the triangle are vying for the attention and affection of the third, which is played, the character played by Austin Butler. His character's name is Benny in this movie. And I thought all of the performances in this film are really solid, but I wanted to give an extra shout out to Jodie Comer, who is one part of that love triangle that's going on in the center of the story. She does a great job at really holding this film together. My first exposure to her was in the first season of Killing Eve, which could not be a more different role than this, but she is really excellent here. She is so refreshingly open in a story that in some ways is about tight-lipped characters not really expressing their emotions aloud. So I thought she was great. Okay, let's see. Before we get into the interview, I wanted to provide a little bit of background about a topic that comes up during the conversation. Well, two things, actually. So first of all, this movie is based on a book of photographs by a guy named Danny Lyon, who took a bunch of photos of a real motorcycle club that was founded in Illinois back in the day. So at a few different points in this conversation, Jeff mentions Danny, and that's who he's talking about, Danny Lyon, the creator of this book. But also, back in 2016, it was announced that Jeff Nichols would be directing a remake of a film called Alien Nation, which came out in 1988, and it tracks what happens in the aftermath of aliens coming to Earth. So years after their arrival in that film, an LA cop played by James Caan is partnered up with an alien police officer played by Mandy Patinkin, and Khan's character really does not like him, does not like the aliens in, I guess, invading Earth or whatever. So Jeff Nichols' version wasn't going to be a direct remake, but as you'll hear, there was a whole series of events that happened with the development of that project that led to where we are now. So he gives me a little bit of an update about what the status of that project is. So I think that's all the background you need to know. So here is my conversation with Jeff Nichols. There's no way that you're going to remember this, but the last time that I spoke with you was at Sundance 2011, right after a screening of Take Shelter. We just stood outside the theater and talked about how great Michael Shannon was for a little bit.
That still holds.
Yeah. I legitimately thought that he should have been in like serious awards contention for that performance. He's unreal in that movie. I love that film.
Thanks for saying that.
Yeah, absolutely. So Slash Film spoke with you in 2018, and you mentioned back then that you had been kicking around the idea of making a biker movie for about 5 years at that point. And you even said that Michael Shannon was joking that you'd been talking about it for so long that he thought you were never actually going to make it. And that was 6 years ago. So how did the movie change since your original conception of it?
I don't know if change is the right word. It just evolved into what it is. You know, there was so much about this original idea that terrified me as a filmmaker. You know, I grew up in the South. My films, typically in terms of the aesthetic, is really austere, especially in terms of the score and the use of non-diegetic music is almost non-existent. And no voiceover. You know, there were so many things about the nature of this film, the fact that it was in the Midwest, the fact that it was about motorcycle culture, something that I really have never been a part of. You know, then going kind of deeper into the idea of the way that it's structured, the way that it's built, the way that it's directed, all these things were a little outside of my comfort zone, to be sure. And so for me, the thing that took the longest amount of time was just figuring out, I guess, how to do it, you know, how I fit into it as a filmmaker and as a storyteller. And, you know, the first kind of thing to address was, well, I don't really want to go do a deep dive and research into the Chicago Outlaws, which is a real club. You know, I want to fictionalize this. I really only want to focus on the world that Danny photographed and the people that Danny spoke to. I don't really want to go outside of that. So how much do I fictionalize? How much do I have to make up while still being able to retain enough from the book to make it give people the feeling that the book gives? And it just took a lot of time. It took a lot of work. You know, it wasn't until about, I guess, 2019 that I really sat down to say, like, all right, now's the time. Let's get it done.
Mm-hmm. So did you go through a bunch of different drafts in terms of striking that balance between the fictionalization and things like that?
No, you know, a lot of it was kind of talking through things with Danny. I think I reached out to Danny around 2014. I'd found the book, you know, in 2003. So, you know, already it's kind of long gestating. And I kind of, when I reached out to Danny, I had the shape of a story. You know, I knew I wanted it to go across the 60s. The book that I found, or the edition of his book that I found in 2003 was a later edition. So it had a second foreword where he speaks very elegantly about the old outlaws and the fact that this club that he had ridden with in the 60s was no more. It had, you know, morphed into this other different thing. And I liked that idea. That felt like an ending, you know? So I had the scope of it, but I didn't really have this love triangle in the middle of it. That would be my invention, you know? And that really ended up becoming, for lack of a better term, the plot that the thing turned on. So I don't write a lot of drafts. It's more about kind of talking it out with people, kind of laying it out for friends. I talked a lot to my older brother, Ben, about it. He was the first one that introduced me to the book. So he knew it intimately. And through just kind of the process of honestly kicking it around, I kind of found this balance of how much to fictionalize and how much of the real book to take.
I'm interested in what you said earlier about, like, basically you had to teach yourself to change your directing style a little bit for this movie. So I was wondering if you could talk more about that idea and sort of what you were trying to achieve here that maybe you hadn't in your other films, or what kind of, what that process looked like for you.
Yeah, for sure. You know, my whole directing style always comes from the writing. You know, I'm very fortunate to be a writer director. I think it's kind of a rare thing. And if I knew I wanted a movie that felt different aesthetically, I knew I would have to write differently. So pretty much, if you could see over here to my left, I have an entire wall of cork. And usually I'm writing these note cards out, you know, I've got them for all sorts of projects. And before I type one page of a screenplay, I have the entire outline of the film worked out. I can just sit here and I can watch it from note card to note card to note card. Mainly because before I get into the writing or typing, I really want to know the balance of the thing, the structure of the thing. And Bike Riders was the first project I didn't do that on. Bike Riders, I set out, I wrote the first scene, and, you know, I had this bigger shape that this thing would devolve into, you know, more violence and kind of an uglier side of biker culture by the end. I knew that, you know, it would be reflective of kind of this path through the 1960s and this kind of change in culture. You hold all that stuff in your mind, but I don't exactly know what scene's coming next. I knew I wanted them to burn down a bar. I knew there were these things, these events that would happen, but I would just take each scene. And then by the time I'd get to the end, I'd kind of look at everything and go, all right, what happens next? And the benefit of that was I really wanted to create the first hour of this film to just flow, you know, to bounce from one scene to the other. In fact, if you really look at it, there's usually a piece of voiceover that overlaps, you know, as like a pre-roll to the next scene. And so that one thing is just one boom, boom, boom. And that ride doesn't really stop for about an hour. And then the film shifts, and then the nature of the film shifts. And that kind of became more traditional, I guess, to my filmmaking style.
Yeah, I'm from Florida, so I appreciate that you're one of the few working directors who has taken an active interest in making movies in the South that feel grounded and not, you know, riddled with the sort of cliches that Hollywood typically paints this area of the country with. I was wondering, though, you kind of alluded to it earlier, but like, this is the first of your movies, I think, that has been outside of the South in that way. What was it like taking yourself out of that environment and tackling something set in the Midwest?
It was really nerve-wracking. It's not something I felt really comfortable doing. So I just leaned into this audio even more than the photographs. You know, the photographs, obviously, we distributed to all the department heads. Like, they were, you know, a core resource for the visuals of this film. But it was the audio that really gave me confidence. I would probably say 60-70% of Jodie Comer's lines as Kathy are from the real audio. So that it almost felt like training wheels, you know, for a non-Midwesterner to say, okay, well, I know what those sound like because I can hit play on this QuickTime file And I can hear what that sounds like. So I know what correct is supposed to be. And then at some point you listen to them over and over and over and again, to the point to where now my words start sounding like Kathy's. You know, I felt confident that, you know, I could write for that character, and it would be in line with this other audio. You know, there's a great Michael Ritchie film. It was a made for TV movie on HBO back in the 90s. And I always get the title wrong, but it's something to the effect of, you know, the incredibly true story of the alleged Texas cheerleader murdering mom. And it starred Holly Hunter and Beau Bridges. And it was based on a real story of a woman that was that tried to hire her brother-in-law to kill a competing cheerleader that was competing against her daughter. Mm-hmm. And the brother-in-law recorded all of these sessions, and they turned that into the dialogue, and Holly Hunter really brought it to life. And I had that in the back of my mind. Like, I have this opportunity where I have this real dialogue. And if I could just, you know, somehow thread it into a narrative that I come up with, how great would that be? You know, and the result is the Bike Riders.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So you mentioned Jodi, and she's so great in this movie. I want to ask you about working with the three main actors here. And to me, it seems like the reason you hired them is pretty self-evident. Like, they're great actors, but I'm specifically curious about what they brought to their roles or what they did on set that surprised you. So tell me about Jodi. Was there anything that she did that took you by surprise?
I mean, I have to be honest, it's a little bit embarrassing to say, but I wasn't, you know, hugely familiar with Jodi's work. After I cast her, I went and watched Killing Eve, but I was really taking a line from my casting director, Francine Maisel. She was just like, before I got on my first Zoom with her, you know, Francine called and was like, just go get her, you know, get her to say yes. And the last time Francine had said that was when I was casting Midnight Special, and I was talking to an actor that I didn't know, and that was Adam Driver. So I've learned to listen to Francine and, mm-hmm. And trust her. But Jodi was just a continual joy and surprise in the work ethic that she applied to this role. When I first spoke to her on the Zoom, the thing that was so captivating was the way that she spoke about Kathy. She talked about Kathy really with love. You know, she really felt things for Kathy, and that's how I felt about Kathy. I thought Kathy was introspective and frustrating at times and self-deprecating and hilarious. And Jodi spoke about her that way. So I knew we were on the same page there. When it came to Jodi's talent, it wasn't until I was passing through London to actually talk to Tom Hardy for the first time in person that I went to see Jodi's one-woman show, Prima Facie. And I walked out thinking, well, this is one of the greatest performances I've ever seen. Now I have this ace up my sleeve, which is Jodi Comer. And, you know, she just murdered it. One day, she left some of her work behind. You've seen the film, you know how much dialogue she has. And she'd phonetically broken down every single word to build that accent. Just a tremendous amount of work. And then you've got a guy like Tom, who you never see that guy working, but he's doing all that work, you know, behind the scenes before he gets there, and had really latched on to this scene in the film about Marlon Brando. Because that came out of the book, actually. There was a scrapbook page from the guy who started, you know, the Outlaws, and he had been inspired by watching The Wild One on TV one night. And so I had lifted that and put that in the script, but Tom really took hold of that. And he kept saying, you know, you can't be half a gangster. And I think what he meant by that was, you know, this guy's not really a biker gang leader. This guy is a middle-class, working-class guy, truck driver, owns a house in the suburbs with a wife and two kids. So he's playing the part. He's actually playing Marlon Brando. And he really did. It's kind of like a performance within a performance. But the thing that you get out of Tom, to be honest, that is most, well, there are a lot, a lot of things about Tom that are very compelling. There is a sexuality to Tom that, honestly, I hadn't fully calculated. There's just a sensuality to him, might be a better term, actually. And I knew I would have this relationship between this older guy who was looking at this younger guy and obviously wanted him to take over the club. That's kind of a part of the plot. But there's this character thing, and it's not a father-son relationship. That's not it. It's that this older man covets this younger man. He covets his youth. He covets the freedom that this guy represents. And Tom really brought that out in a way that was far more intense than what was on the page. I'll put it that way. And I have to give him a lot of credit for that. And then you have Austin. You know, Austin, I met and I had seen him in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I'd seen the trailer for Elvis, but Elvis wasn't out yet. But everything I'd seen of him, even in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he had kind of dark hair. And when and the Benny in the book, although you never see his face in the book, he had kind of blonde, sandy hair. And when Austin walked up to me at this, you know, restaurant we met at for the first time in LA, he had this blonde, sandy hair. He looked just like what I had in my mind. So much so, you know, I built that character as a bit of a myth, because in the book, he's never interviewed by Danny. He's only talked about by Kathy. And the photographs, you never see his face.
Oh,
so you hear all these legendary stories of him, and then you never see his face. So much so that when Danny finally showed me a picture of his face, an outtake from the book, I was like, that's not him. Like, that's not what he looks like. Like, he looks like Austin Butler, which is this kind of undeniable, you know, irresistible young man. And that's what Austin is. The part with Austin that I hadn't calculated was just how talented he is. You know, this guy is he's a movie star, yes, but this guy's got some acting chops. And I look forward to seeing those worked out in the years to come.
Yeah, for sure. So you came close to directing Aquaman, and you've said that the reason you didn't end up making that
close movie... is a strong term. I came close to directing Aquaman. Discussions were had. Yes.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I think you said the reason that you ended up sort of stepping away from that or not taking that job or whatever was that it felt like you were trying to jump onto a moving train and you preferred to work on things more from the ground up. And I was just curious now DC is sort of starting from scratch. Have you had any discussions with James Gunn, Peter Safran over there about maybe working on anything?
My voicemail box is empty. Okay. I haven't gotten any calls. So no, right. I haven't heard about that. But, you know, I'm kind of just focused on original stuff right now. And, okay. But we'll see. I mean, you never know. They can find my number if they want to.
Well, one of those original things, there was a story a few years ago that came out. It was around the same time that I think you were working on A Quiet Place Day One, was that you were developing an original sci-fi movie for Paramount. I was wondering if that was still on. Is that still something you're working on?
That is still on. I finished the latest rewrite of that, which I'm really, really proud of. A couple months back, turned it into them. And we are in serious talks, you know. We'll see. It's a very expensive film. And anytime you make a film at that level, you kind of have to deliver it up to the studio gods, you know, and we'll see what happens. But it takes place in Arkansas. It says everything I want to say about humanity and the universe and the way things work. I'd be very, very happy if I got to make that film.
Were you able to sort of incorporate any of the Alien Nation stuff into this new project? Because I know that one.
Well, that's actually the script that it is. So,
oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. The way that the Alien Nation thing came about is they called and were like, hey, do you want to remake this? And I was like, look, I'm a fan of the original film, but no, I don't believe in remakes. Like, why? I said, but I have this original idea. Would you all like to hear it? And they really liked that idea. And they're like, can we put that title on there? Sure, I don't care. You know, give me $100 million. You can put any title you want on it. And then, of course, you know, the Fox-Disney merger happened and Disney didn't want to move forward with it. And we were able to get it over to Paramount without that title. So it is really this one project that I've just been working on for years and years and years. And I still really love it.
That's awesome. I'm really excited to see that. I wanted to close with one more thing about the bike riders, and it sort of goes to the what you're talking earlier about Tom and Austin's character and the sort of intimacy between them. There's that shot where the two of them separate themselves from the rest of the group, and it's framed and lit in such a way where it almost looks like it could be the start of a love scene between them. Like the blocking is even set up where they're sort of offset from each other, but the angle makes it look like their mouths are almost touching. And there's just such an incredible intimacy there. Tell me about actually executing that scene, you know, coming up with the idea and maybe conversations you might've had with them about it.
All of that credit really needs to go to Tom and to Austin for staying in it. You know, we shoot on film, so you have to have a lighting plan in advance. And for that, we had a crane and, you know, with this big boom arm that had this overhead light so that you could actually see. And our lights were placed very specifically for a really specific execution of that scene, which is Tom's leaning on his bike and Austin hobbles over on his crutches and stands in front of him. And Tom at some point was supposed to get up and face him. And we knew that we'd have this two shot right here. Well, actually we didn't, I'm sorry, I'm saying that wrong. We knew that we would have these two over the shoulders because I was going to look over Austin's shoulder at Tom and then we would see his light or his bike. And then, so we put all this light to light up the background back there. And then I wanted an over the shoulder of Tom looking at Austin and we'd see the campfire and we'd see all the other guys and everybody sitting around there. It made a lot of sense. So that's where all of our light went. None of our light went actually in between them. That's where the base of our crane was. And so, you know, it's a steady cam shot. So you have some, you know, fluidity, an ability to follow them, but they were never really supposed to get that close. And so we start rolling on Tom and Austin can't go anywhere because he's on a crutch, you know, and he's got his foot in a cast. And Austin and Tom just starts getting closer and closer. And my Steadicam operator keeps coming around and we're like, oh God, because like, if you go too far, you're going to see the base of our crane just right there. Tom kept getting closer and closer. And I look over to my cinematographer who was not lit for this. And Tom's face goes into darkness. And Adam, who I've worked with on all six films, he just kind of drops his head like this, but Tom's so damn smart. He gets so close and then he just cocks his head like this and this piece of light comes across his face and they're all in leather, you know? And so Tom is like, you know, flexing his muscles and this leather is kind of creaking and we're all just watching it. Like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And that's the way the audience watches the scene. It is oddly dangerous and intimate and sensual. It is all of those things. And I have to give Austin credit too. He stayed right there in it and he doesn't retract. He doesn't flinch, but he also doesn't, you know, move in for it. It was a very powerful moment. And we shot that in the first week. And I went up to the actors afterward and I said, guys, you know, who I don't know really well at this point. I said, guys, look, I dream all this stuff in my head when I write it, you know, I have it in my head. And to me, a good day is when we've captured what was in my head. That to me is a successful film shoot day. But every once in a while, we shoot something that's better than what was in my head. And that's just what you guys did tonight. And I think we got something special going here. And you could tell they felt it too. And it was a really great way to kind of kick off that movie.
That's amazing. Well, I'm out of time with you, but thank you so much for your time, Jeff, and congrats again on the film. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for talking to me.
All right. I hope you all enjoyed that. That's going to do it for today's show. You can find more about The Bike Riders, including our review of the movie at slashfilm.com. I will link to our review in the show notes so you can find it directly, very easily right there. Slash Film Daily is published normally every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about this show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.